This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. Today we're going to talk about children's books and the top grossing movie of the year. The radical left are invading our children's libraries. Many of the children's books you grew up with are being pushed aside or canceled in favor of an entirely new library of literary offerings aimed at indoctrinating even the youngest children with the leftist agenda. We'll hear a report from Rufaro Manyepa about this trend. Then the biggest movie of the year. It was just released in September, but it's already completely blown the biggest movie of 2020 out of the water. And the amazing thing is that it hasn't even hit the American market yet. It is a Chinese movie, and it's made nearly $1 billion in China. What's even more interesting, it's a war movie celebrating China fighting off American forces in the Korean War. Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic will explain the significance of the battle at Lake Xinjiang. Then, when will Germany get a government? Negotiations are hitting rough waters as the disparate parties try to find common ground. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer will update us on what is happening politically in Germany and the ramifications of a leaderless Germany. And for the last word on today's show, I'll be talking about how keeping the 10th commandment will make you a much happier person. Let's start now with this report on woke new children's books from Rufaro Manyepa.
Bookstores around America are beginning to be dominated by wokeness. Classic children's books from authors such as Roald Dahl and Dr. Seuss are being canceled. They're being replaced by woke children's books that attack traditional stances on sexuality, champion activism, and rail against allegedly universal forms of discrimination. And the implication is that this is what children should be taught instead of the quote-unquote hurtful literature that is now being discarded. But what if this woke literature is really just a tool that allows radicals to indoctrinate America's future with left-wing propaganda? Well, I visited my local Barnes & Noble bookstore to see what it was publishing and promoting there. And while there were many innocuous books on offer, some of the titles they had for children as young as 3 years old were books such as Pride, The Story of Harvey Milk and the Rainbow Flag. They had The Stonewall Riots, Coming Out in the Streets, and also a book titled Bling Blaine, Throw Glitter Not Shade. That was a book about a young boy named Blaine who spreads positivity by throwing glitter, which is something that was looked down upon since he was a boy, but was actually supposedly good. Now, a Gallup poll released earlier this year found that LGBT identification has been increasing over time because, quote, younger generations are far more likely to consider themselves to be something other than heterosexual, end quote. Now, over the last decade, there's been a rapid increase in pro-LGBT music, television, and curricula, but books are now beginning to join the fray as well, particularly children's books. Now, here are some of the more popular woke children's book titles. You have a book titled Daddy and Dada. You've got Daddy, Papa and Me, Mommy, Mama and Me. There's Two Grooms on a Cake, The Story of America's First Gay Wedding, and even LGBT Families. These are all books that are aimed at children as young as 3 months old. Now, those ones that I just read out are very clear in the messaging that they're promoting, but some others like Stella Brings the Family and Donovan's Big Day sound pretty harmless, but they're all promoting LGBT family values. And that's just the beginning. It only gets worse. Just last month, a Texas mother found a book titled Gender Queer in a school library, and this book contained legitimate visual porn of homosexual teenage boys. A new list of recommended books released by the American Booksellers Association included a list full of LGBT books. Some of them were a feel-good contemporary romance about a young trans athlete fighting a discriminatory law targeting trans athletes. There was a book about a young lesbian with pansexual and non-binary friends who denounced their white privilege. And there was a queer coming-of-age story about a young lesbian who joins the football team. And from there, it only gets even more bizarre and even more disturbing. There was a young adult novel about gender fluidity written by a non-binary writer who is the mother of a transgender child. Another was a tale of self-discovery about a bisexual love triangle, as well as a book about a transgender witch named Wyatt. There was even a fabulously joyful novel, quote-unquote, about drag, prom, and embracing your inner queen that featured a fat, openly gay boy stuck in a small West Texas town. Now, none of this is to say that there's a complete absence of children's books featuring traditional families anymore, but they are rapidly disappearing and being replaced. Many other children's books are aimed at the outright radicalization of even toddlers. Many of these books are peddling radicalism masqueraded as harmless rhyme and bright colors. There's a book titled Anti-Racist Baby that makes the assertion that, quote, anti-racist baby is bred, not born, end quote. Woke Baby is a book which is for all the littlest progressives waking up to seize a new day of justice and activism. And then A is for Activist is a book for families who want their kids to grow up in a space that is unapologetic about activism, environmental justice, civil rights, LGBT rights, and everything else that activists believe in and fight for. Children are being taught to fight the power when they're barely out of the crib. They're being taught that they were born racist and have to be bred not to be. Children as young as 3 years old are being indoctrinated in leftist talking points before they even have the ability to think for themselves. With titles like these, with books like these on offer, you have to ask, what can three-year-olds possibly know about fighting for civil rights? How can they even know? How can they recognize and discern how the radical left weaponizes issues like race? And it's actually the big guns of the left that are taking the lead in shaping the next generation. Former President Barack Obama has a self-titled children's book. It's called Barack Obama, Son of Promise, Child of Hope. Jill Biden wrote an adulatory biography on her husband titled Joey, The Story of Joe Biden. Kamala Harris has a book written about her for three-year-olds titled Kamala Harris Rooted in Justice. And she authored one herself called Superheroes Are Everywhere. I mean, you have to ask, why do the leading members of the Democrat Party have self-aggrandizing books aimed at children who barely know what a politician is? All of this is a lot bigger than these figures just wanting to influence the next generation of voters to be fans of Barack Obama and the Democrat machine. It's a lot more important than who's going to the polls. This issue about children being indoctrinated with these leftist views is all about foundational ideals. It's about reshaping society. Because ideals, they either form or destroy civilization. They determine the natural progression of a society. They impact social harmony, economic prosperity, and even geopolitical policy. And the longevity and impact of a set of ideals depends greatly on what children are being taught. Vladimir Lenin, communist and founder of the Soviet Union, once famously said, "Give me just one generation of youth, and I'll transform the world. Now, there's a transformation happening here in the United States. Barack Obama himself promised in 2008 to fundamentally change America. And America is indeed undergoing a radical transformation from a constitutional republic to a communist state, of which indoctrination of the youth is a hallmark. The communists want to reshape society. They want control over your children. They want to keep parents out of education and out of instruction. They want to teach your children that they were born racist, that there are as many genders as there are letters on the alphabet, and that they should rebel and protest against anyone who says differently. They want to funnel all of this into children's minds from a young age so that they never think differently. They don't want the next generation to be able to think independently. That is what the communist infiltration is all about.
Thank you very much for that, Rufaro. No child is too young to be a target of indoctrination by radical leftists. What has your research found is the effect that this kind of teaching, these kinds of books, are having on young people?
Yeah, as I said earlier, the largest population that identifies as LGBT in America is among young people.
Right.
And so the effects on them are pretty clear. And to sum it up, they're miserable. Right. Studies show that suicide is the second most common cause of death for young adults overall. But lesbian, gay, and bisexual kids are three times more likely to attempt suicide than heterosexual kids. It finds that 41% of transgender adults attempt suicide. Right? These are really horrible statistics. And that's what makes it mystifying when you think that if the largest number of people that are, you know, depressed and suffering from anxiety and are likely to attempt suicide and succeed in that, why would you want to teach children that this is something you should aspire to? Why would you want to indoctrinate children to say that this is how to identify as? There's one other book that I came across while I was looking this up, and it goes through the ABCs of society and what you need to what children need to know as far as the alphabet is concerned. And it had L is for LGBTQIA+. Mm. And then it specifically said, find which one best describes you. And I thought it was interesting that none among those letters describe someone who's cisgender or just a regular heterosexual person. Mm-hmm. The options that children are being given are simply the ones of identifying as LGBT, etc., etc.
Yep.
It's not even an option anymore. And you see it in society today. More and more young people are identifying as something different. But it's ruining them. It's making them so sad and miserable.
You know, it's interesting to look at what you are presenting here in light of what's happening in school boards and this whole movement to thrust the parental role out of the schools, push parents out. And the parents who are standing up for, and they're finding these books in the libraries, and they're standing up and they're showing them before school boards and saying, who approved this? Why are you pushing this on our children? They're the ones that are the most vilified. And you know, it really is like what Stephen Fleury has been talking about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, part of this communist attack on family, just aimed at undermining family. And they really do know how to produce propaganda that's going to make parents' jobs that much more challenging. And really, it does come down to how determined are parents to resist this movement and protect their children and stand up and fight for their children.
You're absolutely right. Parents have to take a vested interest and take action in how their children are being educated. You know, it's so easy for, you know, kids to just go online and to see that this book has been recommended or I should read this, and for them to read things and learn things that their parents have no idea about. You know, but if you look in the Bible, in Proverbs 22, verse 9, it says, "Train up a child in the way that he should go, and he will not depart from it." You know, that implies that there's a way that a child should go. There's a way that God determined should be the way that the child is raised. And that takes effort. That takes active involvement from the parents. And if parents ignore their children, you can be guaranteed that the government isn't going to do that. They have an idea for what they want society to be like. Yep. And children are definitely going to be targeted. But We need to look to God's instruction and how he instructs children needs to be raised. All the values he says children need to be raised with. And we have a book, Child Rearing with Vision, which is excellent in just outlining exactly how God in his law says we need to protect our children from all the evil that's in this world, that's going to make them absolutely miserable. It's only his way that's going to produce children that are actually happy, that are actually at peace, as opposed to these startling statistics we see from children in this world.
Yeah, that's a great point. Child Rearing with Vision, the value in the instruction in that book just becomes more and more apparent as you see this kind of confusion and radicalism being promoted on such a massive scale in society around us. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about woke children's books. He's written an article that appears on thetrumpet.com. You can find that, "What Are Your Children Reading?" You can find that in the really on the front page of The Trumpet. We'll link to it in the show notes, but also this book, Child Rearing with Vision. Really encourage you to get a free copy of this invaluable resource. Thanks so much, Rufaro. It's great to have you on.
Always a pleasure, sir.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
China has a huge market for movies. In fact, lately it's been more successful than Hollywood. And what is the biggest Chinese blockbuster of the year about? We'll learn the answer in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
Since July 7th this year, U.S. General MacArthur, leading Marine forces, announced war on North Korea.
That was a selection of sound bites from scenes from The Battle at Lake Changjin, a Chinese war epic released this September. The movie ranks as the top-grossing movie of 2021 worldwide. As of November 9th, IMDb Pro calculates the global revenue of The Battle at Lake Changjin at over $874 million. By comparison, IMDb Pro lists the top-grossing movie of 2020 as earning about $461 million. The Battle at Lake Changjin depicts a group of Chinese winter warriors who heroically fight off advancing American forces in North Korea during the Korean War. Chinese patriots face off an intimidating Yankee army at Lake Changjin, better known to Westerners as Chosin Reservoir. The main villain is United States General Douglas MacArthur. The movie was announced earlier this year as part of the celebrations of the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party, which took place July 1st. We will not accept sanctimonious preaching from those who feel they have the right to lecture us, said Chinese President Xi Jinping during the commemoration. Xi continued, We will never allow anyone to bully, oppress, or subjugate us. Anyone who tries will find them on a collision course with a steel wall forged by 1.4 billion people. The world's top-grossing movie, with all of its bombs, blood, and bullets, shows the world what kind of steel wall Xi had in mind. The Battle of Chosin Reservoir, fought between November 27th and December 13th of 1950, marked the end of the United Nations' advance into North Korea. A 2018 article at National Interest called it the decisive moment of the war. About 120,000 Chinese soldiers faced off 30,000 UN troops made up of Americans, Brits, and South Koreans. The Chinese won the battle and forced the UN troops to flee, but it cost the Chinese greatly. Encyclopedia Britannica estimates the Chinese Ninth Army's total losses to be between 40,000 and 80,000 people, including both combat losses and those who died from the elements due to a Siberian cold front, which made temperatures that winter even more extreme. The UN forces, meanwhile, lost roughly 17,800 people, most of them American. There are many issues with this film. For one, North Korea invaded South Korea, and the UN forces were fighting a defensive war. Also, China declared war on the US when Washington had no ambition to go to war with Beijing in the first place. General MacArthur, meanwhile, was the man who saved China from Japan. And China's leader at the time, Mao Zedong, killed far more Chinese than MacArthur ever did. Yet one noteworthy aspect of the battle at Lake Changjin may not receive as much attention. To understand what this is, we first have to look at the historical context. The Korean War lasted between 1950 and 1953. America had recently come out of World War II as the preeminent power in Asia, following the two atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. U.S. troops were stationed everywhere, from South Korea to Japan to the Philippines to Australia. America was the center of the free world. It was the economy that the rest of the capitalist world revolved around. The U.S.'s global influence was at an apex. However, the Soviet Union also enjoyed a burst of energy following World War II. Joseph Stalin took advantage of the crumbling empires of Germany and Japan to spread communism in both Europe and Asia. North Korea was one of those regions newly introduced to communism. A clash between communism and capitalism was bound to happen at some point. And the first shots of this new Cold War were, in many ways, fired in Korea. America, to this time, had been unbeatable in its major wars. The Revolutionary War, the Mexican-American War, the U.S. Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and World War II were all victories. And with each victory, America's power kept growing and growing. During World War II, it fought a war on two fronts and two continents and won. America was undefeated. But in the Korean War, America was defeated. The Korean War was technically a stalemate, although South Korea's independence was preserved. North Korea should have been an easy foe to smash. And it was. U.S. troops made it to the border with China. But once the Chinese intervened, the tide turned. Practically all the gains made by the U.S. troops were lost. The mighty American superpower that defeated Adolf Hitler's panzers and Emperor Hirohito's zeros couldn't stop Mao's People's Volunteer Army, and General MacArthur, one of America's greatest generals, ended his career on a low note. Korea was only the first taste of decades of lost wars. The Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961 was a fiasco. The Vietnam War ended with Saigon falling to the communist forces in 1975. The 1979 to 1981 Iran hostage crisis was a foreign policy disaster. And the humiliating retreat from Afghanistan this year shows that this trend has continued. It's as if America is cursed. Herbert W. Armstrong, editor-in-chief of The Trumpet's predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, proved in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that America is descended from ancient Israel. This fact has everything to do with America's history as an unmatchable military power. Millennia ago, God made a promise to the patriarch Abraham, the forefather of the Israelites, that he would make of his progeny a great nation. God told Abraham, "I will bless you and make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you and curse him that curses you." You can read that in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Later, God promised the Israelites certain blessings if they kept his law. Those blessings included the following: "And you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. And 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword. And all people of the earth will see that you are called by the name of the Eternal, and they will be afraid of you. And the Eternal will make you the head and not the tail, and you will be above only and not beneath." You can read those blessings in Leviticus chapter 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28. God also promised Israel curses if they disobeyed his law. Here are a few examples, again from Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. "And I will set my face against you, and you will be slain before your enemies. They that hate you will reign over you, and you will flee when none pursues you. And I will break the pride of your power, and your strength will be spent in vain. The Eternal will cause you to be smitten before your enemies. You will go out one way against them, and flee 7 ways before them." Speaking of Israel, Micah chapter 5, verse 9 reads that all your enemies will be cut off. Mr. Armstrong wrote in The United States and Britain in Prophecy, quote, "They were cut off from the beginning of God's birthright blessing on America and Britain, starting about 1803, through the First World War, the Second World War, until the turning point of the Korean War at the end of 1950. Since that time, however, these blessings are surely being taken away, and neither America nor Britain has come out on top in any major skirmish since that time," end quote. That turning point was the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. America was a military superpower, but unlike almost every other superpower of history, America used its strength as a force for good in the world. World Wars I and II were fought to preserve the freedom of the world. So was the Cold War. America sent so many of its sons abroad and spent billions of dollars to help other nations have what it had: freedom, prosperity, and security. America was a blessing to the world. Since the Korean War and each subsequent lost war, other powers have been growing stronger and stronger. Powers like the People's Republic of China, and their aims are far less altruistic. The rise of countries like China heralds what the Bible calls, in Luke chapter 21, verse 24, the times of the Gentiles. The rest of the chapter details what kind of place the world would be once countries like China call the shots. Here are a few select quotes. "For these be the days of vengeance. There shall be great distress in the land, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations." Scriptures like these show a much scarier reality than the world during Pax Americana. This is what makes the movie The Battle at Lake Changjin important. It's a giant announcement that the times of Israel are gone and the times of the Gentiles are moving in. The collision course President Xi talked about is about here. The movie is like a proclamation from Beijing. Israel has been cursed to military failure since the Korean War. We were the nation to inflict the first blow, and they haven't stopped coming since. And this is worth celebrating. Move over, America. The 21st century belongs to countries like China. And the fact that the battle at Lake Changjin is 2021's largest grossing movie means that a lot of people, at least in China, are very excited about this. This does not bode well for the world. To learn more, please read the Trumpet's Trends article, "Why the Trumpet Watches America Has Won Its Last War," by Trumpet executive editor Stephen Fleury. Also, please request a free copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy to learn about America's biblical heritage and what this means in the modern day. You can find both at thetrumpet.com.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. China really has a lot to celebrate these days. It's a world power with a growing sense of self-confidence. You can see it in movies like this and the way that it's conducting itself on the world stage. You wrote this past summer about how it celebrated its 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, it's China's come a long way from 100 years ago, 1921. Back then, it was still one giant cake that Japan and other powers have been taking slices from at will. They had a bloody civil war between the communists and the nationalists. And by the time the People's Republic of China was established in 1949, China had already seen so much bloodshed through World War II, through the Chinese Civil War. And in one sense, it was a bit of a respite from all the wars and foreign invasions. But in another sense, China, the Communist Party's legacy isn't the cleanest, even by the standards of other communist countries. Mao Zedong, of course, was able to rule China for decades and implementing his vision of communism. He brought China through quite a few atrocities, like the Great Leap Forward, his big campaign to industrialize China, which ended up creating the largest man-made famine in history. About 36 million people died in the Great Leap Forward, which lasted just between 1958 to 1962. And then he had the Cultural Revolution, which was Mao's reaction to the reforms that were going into the Soviet Union after Stalin had died. He thought that the Russians were abandoning the purest elements of communism, and so he organized these basically groups of death squads composed of students, most of them teenagers, to hunt down anybody that he saw as a threat to the regime, which included people like teachers, intellectuals, that kind of stuff. And 1 to 2 million people died through these death squads. So there was a lot of bloodshed going on with China through the communist period, but through that forging of steel, almost, you get this new China coming out that's more centralized than ever, more powerful than ever, stronger military than ever, and Mao's successors were able to take the centralized, industrialized state that he basically built on the backs of millions of Chinese and ran with it, creating what is today the second largest economy in the world, the largest military in the world. And because of this legacy, through communism, China is basically the powerhouse that it is today. And examples like this movie, like the Battle at Lake Changjin, are basically the Chinese government and especially President Xi Jinping saying China's come a long way. We've come a long way from our bloody past that wasn't even that too long ago. We're back. We're bigger than ever, and we're ready to start showing the world who's boss now. The era of other countries coming in and taking advantage of China are over. Now we're going to start doing to them what they've been doing to us this whole time.
Very interesting. We've been talking with trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about a Chinese blockbuster movie celebrating China prevailing over America in the Korean War. He's written an article about this. It's up at thetrumpet.com. Chinese Cinema, the Korean War, and the Death of the American Superpower. You can go check that out. Thank you very much, Mihailo.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
When will Germany get a new government? After recent elections, its political parties are struggling to find common ground to form a coalition, as we will now hear in this report from Richard Palmer.
Germany's coalition talks began with a burst of optimism and goodwill. The elections yielded all kinds of complicated coalition negotiations and options. But very quickly, three parties decided they were going to get together and form the next government. And they were very positive about it. The Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Free Democrats agreed the preliminaries of a coalition pretty quickly. And we were told that negotiations would all be over by Christmas. That's a pretty long time for a country to be without a government. But that's much less time than it took for the last coalition to get together. But behind the scenes, party leaders knew it would not be that easy. They've all worked to enforce total silence around their coalition talks. Der Spiegel wrote, "It's a gigantic political experiment. Almost 300 experts from the three parties involved have been meeting for the last 10 days in 22 working groups to define the policies. They want nothing to leak to the outside." That party leaders believe is the only way to avoid the kind of public pressure that might ultimately lead to the talks falling apart. Those involved in the negotiations are eager to present an image of harmony. In reality, though, the parties are still far apart on many controversial issues. And looking at the parties involved, they seem set to remain far apart, even if they paper over their differences enough to form a government. Because there is a lot for them to disagree on. Now, the top priority of Germany's Green Party is environmentalism. It is in their name, very literally. But then the Free Democrats are pro-business, and they're all about low taxes and low regulation. So the Greens want to control a newly created environmental ministry that could veto any government decision if they deem it bad for the environment. And the other parties are not so keen on giving the Greens veto power over everything. The Greens also want to end the sale of new combustion vehicles by 2030 and end coal power by 2038, while the Free Democrats want to support Germany's valuable automotive industry. So the parties may have kept the negotiators quiet, but their own lawmakers haven't always been quite so disciplined. One prominent Green member of parliament complained that his party was standing aboard the Titanic saying, "We should avoid the iceberg," while he accused the other parties of answering, "What will you give us for it?" Foreign policy is another sore spot in these negotiations. Here the groups are arguing at the length of the document that would spell out the foreign policy goals. More substantially, the Greens and Free Democrats would like to see Germany stand up to dictators in countries like Russia and China. But the Social Democrats have traditionally favoured closer relations with Russia, and they accuse the smaller parties of being too idealistic, saying that in the real world you can't snub China. COVID-19 policies could also prove a breeding ground for disagreements. The Free Democrats generally oppose harsh COVID rules and future lockdowns. But COVID cases are rising to record levels, at least according to official figures, and you could soon see pressure building for tougher measures, pressure that the other parties would want to cave into. And nor are the disagreements restricted to policy. The Greens don't trust the SPD Chancellor-in-Waiting Olaf Scholz, nor his team of negotiators, wrote Der Spiegel. The exploratory talks tend to magnify that distrust. And it's not just distrust and disagreement between parties. There's a wide difference even within the parties on some issues. The Social Democrats and the Greens both have major internal divisions. And a lot of this revolves around the military. There's significant factions in both parties that want a radical withdrawal away from the United States-based military alliances, things like NATO. Some want a more pacifistic Germany. Many want to return U.S. nuclear weapons that are on loan to Germany. Now, it does seem like all these different factions could get behind an increase in military spending, but there's fierce disagreement on what they would spend it on. All this means that the coalition is far from a done deal. Politico warned, don't hold your breath on a new German government forming by early December, referring to the target date set by the party leaders. But even if the coalition negotiations succeed, well, the task of governing only just begins. Wolfgang Ischinger, the head of the Munich Security Conference, said the coalition agreement is the lesser challenge. The real problems will begin when they actually have to govern. Now, the easiest way to sort out a sticky coalition issue is to put some vaguely worded platitude that everyone can get behind into the agreement. But then that just causes more problems when it's time to work out what these platitudes mean in practice. So if this coalition succeeds, and at this point that is looking like a bigger and bigger if, it will probably be weak and short-lived. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry covered this in the cover article of our latest Trumpet print issue. And he talked about how this is a crucial moment for Europe. You know, America is weakening under President Joe Biden, and he warned that there was a real recognition in Europe for their need for military unity. The trouble is they lack the robust leadership needed to bring it about. Analysts say Europe is up for grabs. It is no coincidence that at this moment Germany is in acute political turmoil. As a result, all of Europe is leaderless. Now, that turmoil seems set to continue, perhaps even after a coalition is in place. Even in the early days after the election, it was clear that any resulting coalition would be brittle and frail. And as we start to see that potential coalition take shape, well, that assessment is clearer than ever. Mr. Flurry said this is going to produce a magnificent opportunity for someone to assume power through deceit and flatteries. We must closely follow German politics. Europe truly is up for grabs. This political turmoil that we see right now in Germany is paving the way for the fulfillment of a keynote Bible prophecy. The book of Daniel describes the arrival of a strong dictator in a revived Roman Empire. There are very specific verses that talk about this. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21, for example, says, "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." And you can take this passage, you can put that side by side with comments that Jesus Christ made in Matthew chapter 24, referencing the book of Daniel, and see that, you know, this prophecy does have an ancient type, but there's a modern fulfillment here, a modern prophecy of events happening in our day. Anciently, men were naive and credulous. Mr. Flurry wrote in his article, and Antiochus took advantage of them. You had this leader that came up and came in by pretending he was someone he was not, getting an office through flatteries and deceit. And Mr. Flurry talked about in that article how this is a pattern we need to watch for now. That we're going to see a vile person or a despicable creature take control. How could this happen? Well, Europe is facing a lot of crises right now. Mr. Flurry talked about it. You've got the pullout of Afghanistan. You've got this creates a massive security crisis for Europe. You've got economic instability. You've got massive amounts of debt created by nations' response to COVID. You've got problems with terrorism. You've got illegal immigrants surging into Europe, especially after what happened in Afghanistan. You've got threats coming in from Asia. In times of crisis, people are less concerned about democratic norms, wrote Mr. Flurry. They need strong leadership. That has to come from Germany, which dominates and even domineers Europe today. It is the powerhouse. In the end, 10 kings will give their military might to one man and will form a superpower that will shock the world. Europe needs strong leadership, but Germany is faced by an ineffectual coalition. As standard politics stall and coalition governments prove ineffective, well, Germany's going to be ready to turn to something different. They'll be ready to turn to a strong man. Many biblical prophecies feature this strong man. They say he's going to destroy mightily. But he's also a key part of some of the most inspiring prophecies in the Bible as well. This is a man that we need to learn more about. Mr. Flurry's article, Europe is About to Be Hijacked, explains in detail what the Bible says about this strongman and why he will appear on the world scene very soon.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. It is remarkable when you look at all the issues dividing these German politicians. It, in a sense, it reminds me of the political divisions within America, which are growing wider all the time. What's your sense of how divided Germany is? What is there, if anything, that unites Germans? And how would someone come along and break through those divisions that you see?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think Germany is as divided as the United States is. I think you have disagreements between political parties, but I don't see the kind of self-hatred that you see within such a large percentage of the United States within Germany. Yeah, you know, I think there's an agreement, you know, we want to do what's best for Germany. There's just a lot of disagreements as to what that is. Or maybe a better way to put it, I think in Germany, there's an agreement regarding the destination. The disagreement is how to get there. You get to the United States and it seems like the different groups have fundamentally different destinations. So that disagreement that exists within Germany is certainly enough to cause paralysis and to lead to crisis. But I think because it's a slightly different nature to the disagreement within the United States, it's also a disagreement that can be healed. I think one of the astonishing things or remarkable things about the German elections is how much switching up there was between different parties. How many people there were who voted for the right-wing Christian Democrats last time and voted for the left-wing Social Democrats this time. Or maybe they voted Greens last time and Free Democrat this. There was a whole load of switching. And you don't see anything like that within the United States. I don't think you see great numbers of people who voting Democrat this election, then Republican, and then Democrat the next one. You're bouncing around like that. So yes, there is this chaos and instability caused by this lack of a clear election result, but there's not this deep fundamental split in society that you see in the United States. And I think that gives the disagreements within Germany a very different character.
So what do you think unites Germans? And we talk so much about just someone coming along and unifying the country, a lot of people getting behind the vision that you see this man espousing. What do you think that vision is going to be? What will that look like?
Yeah, again, I think that's an interesting thing to look at. I mean, I think that's a vision that the leader himself will have to bring to a certain extent. I mean, this was the common concern about Angela Merkel, or the most common criticism, that she was a manager, not a leader. That she kind of dealt efficiently with crises and organized people well, but she never set out a vision for Germany. She didn't really have a broader vision for what she was doing. She just kind of took each crisis as it came and tried to deal with it. And yet, if Angela Merkel had stood in this election, she would have won, probably very handily. So I think in some ways, her lack of vision is a reflection of a lack of vision within broader German society, partly because of their history, there's a reluctance within other countries and a certain reluctance even within Germany itself to articulate a strong vision. Yeah, you know, if somebody came along and did start talking about, well, we need to make Germany great again, Germany above everything, America first, Germany über alles, you know, that would be quite remarkable and would generate quite a, you know, that they would have to be a very brave politician to do that. Now, I think the appetite is there, And so maybe it will just take a leader that is brave enough to do that, that is to kind of tap into that latent desire for an ambition that we have just seen unfulfilled because no politician wants to go near it, that will really unite Germany. And Bible prophecy also tells us that a religious vision will also play a big role in that. I think economic security is something that is very important for Germans in particular, having lived through hyperinflation and some of these other financial catastrophes, and even some of the financial catastrophes involved in the Cold War and things like that. So I think somebody who will promise safety as well and financial stability would do very well. So I think it will have to be a combination of things, but I think we'll have to be a leader who is capable of articulating a vision and getting people behind it. And maybe a country that has been devoid of vision for 15, 16 years of Angela Merkel, however long it was, it would be a brave politician, but I think they could respond to that powerfully.
Well, it certainly is fascinating to see this, I guess we could say an undemocratic trend within Germany. We spoke recently about just the appetite that German leaders have for maybe a change in the way that leaders are selected, considering the kinds of problems that they're experiencing with trying to compose a governing coalition, and the paralysis that is happening politically within Germany is certainly increasing that appetite. Given what we understand about Bible prophecy, that is definitely a trend that we can expect to continue, and the outgrowth of the problems that Germany is facing right now because of that certainly is going to lead to that outcome. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the problems within Germany in forming a governing coalition. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief on Monday. The title of that article, "Are Germany's Coalition Talks Sinking?" Really excellent article getting into all of those details about what is holding them up. Go check it out. And thank you very much for your time, Richard.
Great to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
Most people agree with the sixth commandment, "You shall not murder." Many are changing their attitudes on the other commandments, like committing adultery, stealing, and lying. Yet people rarely even think about the tenth commandment. But breaking this commandment hurts our entire economic system, our world, and our day-to-day thoughts. "Thou shalt not covet," Exodus 20 and verse 17 says. Now, the Hebrew word translated covet simply means to desire or take pleasure in. Psalm 19 and verse 10, for example, uses the same Hebrew word to say we should desire or covet God's laws. God wants us to desire the right things, but there are things we should not desire. That's why the 10th commandment specifies not desiring other people's houses, spouses, or property. These are things that are out of reach or unlawful or taken at others' expense. And notice that this commandment forbids not the act of stealing or adultery, like the 8th and 7th commandments, but the desire. This commandment outlaws the attitude of get. It forbids us from wrapping our minds in material desires. And why is that? Well, because it pulls our minds away from God. Most Christians claim the Old Testament is an outdated letter of the law set of rules, yet this commandment explicitly governs our minds and our hearts. This is part of God's very way of living, which has always existed and always will exist. Right thoughts lead to right behaviors, wrong thoughts to wrong behaviors. God demands that we expunge wrong thoughts. Our human nature always tends towards selfishness and discontent. The 10th commandment aims to check that tendency. All God's commands are for our happiness, but this is especially obvious with this commandment. Obeying it makes you happy. Disobeying it makes you miserable. today's society enthusiastically breaks the 10th commandment. What woes this brings. Coveting feeds materialism and greed. It fuels our mountainous debt problems individually and nationally. Politicians and manufacturers constantly stir up the spirit of covetousness, telling us we deserve more and better. So despite having so much, we are dissatisfied, always craving and demanding more. Now, without God, we are incomplete. Each of us has a spiritual void. If we try to fill that void with material things, it will never be filled. Yet everywhere, people are doing just that and still feeling the void and then thinking, well, this must mean I haven't gotten enough things. I'll be filled if I can just get that and maybe that and that. This cycle produces untold misery. It sparks conflict between people and within families. It causes war among nations. In a remarkably accurate prophecy about the last days, the Apostle Paul wrote in 2 Timothy 3 that men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous. This is a characteristic of our times. And this also says that people in our day would be unthankful, which is also a direct result of covetousness. Verse 4 perfectly describes another destructive effect. People become, quote, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. Our world today loves pleasure. It can't get enough. It functions like personal pleasure is the highest aim in life. Yet you cannot simultaneously love things and God. Coveting cripples spirit-mindedness. It smothers faith. It destroys your spiritual power. Another prophecy in Ezekiel 33 exposes this spiritual danger. When our minds are focused on acquiring physical things, our thinking becomes shallower and incapable of true spiritual growth. And this is a major obstacle to people responding to God's truth. This prophecy in Ezekiel 33 says, "With their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness." People hear God's correction, but then they just move on. Something else comes to occupy their thoughts and their time. Covetousness is never satisfied. It always looks dissatisfied for what comes next. The Apostle Paul wrote in Colossians 3 and verse 2, "Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth." You might think you can, but you really cannot seek both at the same time. When material pursuits absorb your thoughts, you shove God out. You cannot serve both God and things. Yet it's natural to set our affection on earthly interests and to struggle to cherish the things above. The solution is, Paul says in verse 5 of Colossians 3, to kill off those fleshly tendencies, and that includes covetousness, which is idolatry, he wrote. Yes, at its root, covetousness is idolatry. Breaking the 10th commandment is actually breaking the first commandment, because it puts some material thing and the pleasure you hope to gain from it ahead of God. The 10th commandment helps us to ensure that our priorities in life are right and that we are seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, as Jesus Christ enjoined in Matthew 6 and verse 33. Paul also wrote of how those who desire to be rich fall into many spiritual snares and pierce themselves through with many sorrows. You can read that in 1 Timothy 6. But he gave a wonderful antidote to covetousness: godliness with contentment. Contentment and gratitude are the opposite of covetousness. So if you find yourself falling prey to the gimmies, stop and count your blessings. Ask God for the peace of mind that comes with contentment. Obey the 10th commandment by squelching greed and curbing materialistic thoughts. Cultivate contentment, and you will experience just what a blessing and a boon to your happiness God's law really is. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Rufaro Manyepa, Mihailo Zekic, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Larry Bird. I've got a theory that if you give 100% all the time, somehow things will work out in the end. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.